Coming up today, photo hacks, killer robots, startup factories, and we check out Edinburgh's vibrant startup scene. You're listening to episode 309 of the YGK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business and design. I'm your host, James Templeton. Joining me are Leah Clark.
Hello.
Victoria Wollaston.
Hello.
And Roland Manthorpe.
Hello.
How are we all?
Very well.
Are we good? Vicky, you just got back from Edinburgh.
I did. We're
going to be talking about that a little
beautiful
later.
Beautiful place.
Who wants to go first with their fact?
Go on, Leah.
I bet everyone knows this already, but I didn't. Antarctica is a desert. It's classed as a desert.
What?
Because it doesn't really rain there.
Good.
Yes. It rains less there than in the Sahara. About 50 millimetres of snow falls a year.
But it never really melts, so.
Exactly.
Good fact.
I
didn't know that before.
I think that's interesting.
I didn't know that before.
Vicky, I can see from the notes that your fact is more of a tale. So off you go.
Yeah, a yarn.
So, I'm going to take us back to medieval Europe. So, in medieval Europe, barber surgeons were medical practitioners who, unlike many doctors of the time, they actually performed surgery, and often on the war wounded. Many would have no formal learning, and they were often illiterate. But this is a bit that I found really interesting. The red and white poles that are actually used to identify barbershops today were originally intended to reflect the blood and napkins used to clean up during bloodletting. So barbers used to be swept up with surgeons. They used to get involved with this sort of thing.
Well, it's all blades, isn't it?
Well, exactly. And part of their... They developed a skill for cutting hair off the body when they were doing sort of stuff to bloodlet and do stuff with the brain. So eventually... So they got merged in 1540, but then obviously they realised that surgery is very, very different from being a barber, so yeah. They then separated them again.
So it says here that barbers were forbidden to carry out any surgical procedures except for teeth pulling and bloodletting.
Only those two.
Just those
cut
two.
Cut hair, to pull my teeth, let my blood.
And a friend of mine had a tooth pulled out the other day, and you wouldn't want your barber to be doing that. It's fairly serious work. Roland, what did you learn this week?
Oh, so I learned the joyous fact that between 210,000 and 440,000 people are killed a year in the United States as a result of medical errors.
Not by barbers.
No, by doctors, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's what that means. Get the barbers back involved then.
yeah, exactly.
It's a serious fact.
No, it is a serious
fact.
Yes, I learnt this at Wired Health, which was last week. And an extra little fact about it, this is apparently the deaths spike in June, which is when all the new doctors come in.
Oh, gosh.
After graduation.
Oh.
Well, it makes sense that they'd have that amount of data and sort of granularity in
It's actually apparently very hard to record this data because on a death certificate, it doesn't say, we cocked up on this one. It says something like heart failure, and so it's actually, that's why there's such a big gap between
the
range of deaths.
But how do they know then how do they know their medical errors then? How can we put this number on it if it's not on the death certificate?
Well, because people who know more about this than me have gone back through the data looking at all these death certificates to work out basically if there was medical error at some point in the chain. I only found it out this week, but this relates to a study published last year by the British Medical Journal.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, she said, oh, in a way like that is
actually,
actually a fact.
Yeah. My fact isn't a fact, Roland has informed me. It's more of an urban myth and quite a well-known one, but I'd never heard it before.
Well, I mean, I'd heard of it and I was just assuming that everyone else had.
So
we'll find out.
I've been researching the origins of the burger. And as part of that, I came into some vague trivia around meat tenderizing. So... in the early days of the Tour de France, cyclists improvised to ensure that they had a more comfortable ride. Legend has it that they would buy a cheap... I mean, this is so obviously fake. Legend has it.
Yes. That's always the start of a good fact, isn't it?
They would go to a local butcher's and buy a cheap steak in the morning. And ready for the off, they'd stick the slab of beef down their shorts and sit on it like a cushion. They'd ride like that all day, tenderizing the meat. Oh, come on, this is just ridiculous. Tenderizing the meat with their motion, marinating it with their sweat, and then hand it to a hotel chef. Vicky's lost it. Hand it to a hotel chef in the evening with the instruction that it only needed a minute on each side.
this
tenderizing the meat with their motion.
Exactly. James Templeton reads erotic facts
about cyclists that aren't facts.
Fake news.
It's an oft-reported, apparently, urban myth. And there it is. Okay, okay. Oh, everyone compose themselves, because the first story is a somewhat inappropriate segue from that. Leah.
So next week I want Roland to come on and find out how many people die in the UK due to medical errors. Please.
Ooh, follow-up fact. There you
because
go.
I feel like the UK gets slammed a lot by, like, anti-public healthcare in the US.
The gauntlet.
And they're like, oh, my God, they put the price on the head of people in the NHS in the UK, and they give us all this bad press. Because
there you go. You come on the podcast, Roland, and you get homework.
Yeah, go away and find that out, and then extrapolate how it would, you know, population differences. Right,
check back next week for
I
that.
I never
fact.
Normally get this kind of response for my facts.
Please, more facts.
Yes, a follow up. Well, I'll do my best.
Thank you.
Our first story this week: Emma Watson has been in the news for not very nice reasons for her.
No. Once again, we've had some creepy internet dweller hack the private photo stash of female celebrities. So it's not actually just Emma Watson who's been targeted. Amanda Seyfried and a bunch of other people I've not actually heard of that seem to be American models have also been targeted. And there's the promise of more from these nice individuals. So we know about this because Emma Watson's legal team has publicly confirmed that they're taking action. They haven't said anything more about what that action might be, but likely they'll be targeting sites that have been sharing the stolen images. There was a note on Reddit warning users not to share hacked photos, but they're probably appearing on 4chan, and the reports everywhere say ominously that they're accessible on the dark web.
There's always this slight dodginess to stories like this, that news sites will report that these images are available on the dark web and 4chan. And 4chan is normally where you find this sort of stuff. The incident that we'll talk about a little later, when hundreds and hundreds of female celebrities had nude photos put up online, that was all dumped on 4chan and ready and accessible there. This time, from what I can tell, and this isn't the case with a lot of sites, the offending images in this instance have been removed from 4chan. So someone somewhere is clearly realizing that this can't stand anymore, and that if this stuff appears, it has to disappear.
Yeah.
So in this instance, reports saying that it's on 4chan, as far as I can tell, are wrong.
Well, as I understand, I think on 4chan they can disappear, they can be automated to disappear as well. So that could be happening. Also, I think Emma Watson's team's taking legal action. Amanda Seyfried's team said they might be taking legal action. So they may have already instructed them to take it down. I have to point out, for anyone that's listening that's particularly pervy, the ones of Emma Watson aren't naked, so just, you know, don't even bother yourself. Well, maybe do bother and just waste all your time.
But we've been here before.
I have to say, when you're talking about where they're shared, I had a little look on Twitter and was confronted with lots of lovely, well, explicit images of Amanda Seyfried on someone's Twitter account just sitting there for like 20 hours and they hadn't been touched. So obviously those have been shared far and wide. And I reported them and nothing happened. And then eventually they got removed with no explanation.
So this follows on from about 3 years ago. There was a really, really big attack hacking campaign against iCloud, the Apple sort of backup service.
And Gmail, yeah.
Yeah, hundreds of people were affected. It got its own nickname. People were put into prison because of it and serving quite long jail sentences.
Not long enough.
Still.
Well, they're not that long.
Yeah, but it was a landmark case as far as that goes.
Yeah.
And there was a threat made against Emma Watson a couple of years ago.
There was, some
and
time.
Now this has happened.
Yeah. So, I mean, the threat, there's nothing that suggests the threat from a couple of years ago is related to now. And anyway, the threat from a couple of years ago was this countdown saying, nude photos of Emma Watson coming soon. Ha ha ha, we're going to get her. And she was like, there aren't any. So, and there still aren't any. The photos that have been shared of her are her trying on clothes at a clothes fitting. So,
but I think what James was saying about the landmark case from 2014, maybe that has now set that precedent. So yes, they've been leaked now, but the fact that they've been taken down straight away, there's legal action being launched straight away, there are actual consequences to this now that there's a precedent for, and that's a good thing.
And I think it empowers people like Emma Watson and Amanda Seyfried to straight away, rather than just being, you know, people do this to humiliate people, to upset people, to scare people. And instead, they are straight away responding in a way that will hopefully shut this down quite quickly.
It's putting the power back onto them, that even though this incident has happened, that they just straight away stand up and go, no, taking legal action, let's sort this rubbish out.
Exactly. But
why are people doing
because
this?
Because they're absolute scumbags.
Grow up, guys. For goodness sake.
I mean, both times around. So when they threatened to leak, I was going to say, don't call it leak, even though Amanda Seyfried's legal team said leaked in their statement. It really annoys me because it's like, these are hacked, stolen images. These aren't, you know, private pictures that plopped out of their phone accidentally and fell on the pavement. Like, this is, they were purposefully, they're doing this to harass these people, to humiliate them. So anyway.
But just on that though, just on that, Leah, though, that in a way you can call them leaked though, because if they have been hacked from a server that potentially has a vulnerability, that server has leaked the data. So okay, I completely get your point. Someone had to activate. They didn't just fall out.
On that note, though, the iCloud...
They've been stolen.
The iCloud hack
stolen
was
is probably
not,
the best one.
Yeah, the iCloud hack was not anything to do with Apple services. It was a phishing scheme, and that's probably... Well, it might be the same thing this time around.
But something that we've picked up on that a lot of sites haven't is Twitter's response to this. So while from as far as I can tell, 4chan is perhaps... and this is from a very limited amount of research, gotten better at getting rid of this sort of stuff. Twitter, from what you found, Leah, hasn't.
No, Twitter, I keep looking into this because it keeps coming up with various other things. Pornhub has got this real kind of campaign against them because they say that Twitter should be held to the same standards it's held to in terms of age verification because there's so much pornography on Twitter. And there is, like, if you look eventually, they don't say this explicitly. I've asked them and it takes them forever to say it explicitly. But pornographic images and videos are allowed to be shared on Twitter, which is why I'm sure a lot of this stuff isn't taken down straight away and they don't make a concerted effort. But in this instance, it's stolen images. And I reported the user for harassment and the user wasn't blocked, but eventually the pictures of the more famous celebrities disappeared. And the slightly less famous one seems to have just remained. So I've reported that tweet as well. But Twitter, when I asked them, like, why has this happened? Why, you know, why didn't you get back to me? I've not heard anything. Why were some taken and not others? Why didn't you block the user? You know, we cannot report on individual cases is the response I get. They also referred to me and said that, you know, if you report and receive case numbers, the team will review material and accounts against our rules. I've reported several times different content abuse.
You've been doing this for
users.
Months, haven't you?
Well, you know, I do other things with my time.
No, I know, but in all seriousness, you have been doing this. Yeah. Every time something like this has come up, you've proactively gone and reported it.
And I've never once
and
received
you've not
a case number.
Yeah.
So, and if you have, tell me about it. Twitter. I mean, like,
YGK
people tweeting.
On Twitter, or you are at Leah.
I'm. What am I? At Leah Clark.
It's probably that.
Yeah.
And this does, it highlights the wider point that even though Twitter has made efforts and Facebook has made efforts, but this is specifically a Twitter problem, that the systems in place still aren't up to scratch. It would seem that when instances like this occur, they're still able to proliferate on networks like Twitter.
Yeah, I would imagine that they would refer us to their terms, and their terms say that nude photos are allowed, and it would probably take legal action from Amanda Seyfried, for instance, to say, well, those are stolen and you are by, you know, association.
This is harassment.
So I think they will probably take the stance that until someone does that, they've got no reason to be proactive and waste their time.
So the legal action taken by Emma Watson, whatever that transpires as being, could again set another landmark. And hopefully that this never happens again, saying that it probably
it will.
But when it does, that maybe we'll have moved on even further and have persuaded these social networks that they really need to take this problem seriously and that you could be ruining people's lives.
Yeah.
And I think as well.
Like, certain people go on 4chan or various subreddits. Twitter is like, it's so easily accessible to everyone.
I mean, if you want to get on 4chan, it's just 4chan.
Well, you can, but I mean, like, you can come across things on Twitter probably more frequently and easily if you're not. You don't.
Like, people's parents are on Twitter, for God's
sake. That's what I mean. They're probably not on 4chan.
No. We'll move on. Vicky, our second story this week is less of a story and more of a tale, once again.
Another tale.
Vicky, you spent the first half of this week, as we mentioned earlier, in Edinburgh. But to preface that, why did you go? Because there's something new coming to Wired.
Yeah, so as part of the magazine, we're launching a new section called Work Smarter. And the whole idea behind Work Smarter was to be a bit practical, but useful advice for businesses, and particularly startups, entrepreneurs. So there's going to be how-to guides, how to get funding, how those sorts of things. But also what we're trying to do is really highlight some of the UK hubs. We tend to celebrate a lot of US and other European countries. with their startup hubs, but I think we should start celebrating beyond London some of the places in the UK.
That's the real key, isn't it? There is a problem, and I think we're guilty of this as much as an awful lot of our competitors, although maybe slightly less so, that there is amazing robotics research that happens in Bristol. There is a fantastic startup scene in Manchester, wonderful creative work going on in Leeds and Liverpool and Cardiff and you name it. And Edinburgh, perhaps behind London, is the UK's second biggest city for the kinds of industries that we cover. There's games development, there's a thriving startup scene, there's a real network there, so getting the chance to go up and find out more about it is a great thing to be able to do.
Well, I had a bit of a whistle-stop tour of Edinburgh, so the guy that took me up there was called Kenny Kemp, and he works for City UK. Now, he actually, as a side fact, wrote the tour guides for some of the tour buses.
That's great.
Which was fantastic. So as we're walking around Edinburgh, and Edinburgh is a lot smaller than I thought it was going to be, mm-hmm. you can walk everywhere. He was showing me all of these amazing sites. So I got a
If you look
history.
Out the window to your left,
yes,
this
exactly.
building constructed in 17 years.
Exactly. It was brilliant. But while I was there, one of the most interesting things that I found out about was Archangels. Archangels are a 25-year-old angel investment company in Edinburgh. But they've always sort of specialised in tech. So they've floated Optos, they invested in Touch Bionics. And what was interesting about that is when they invested in Touch Bionics, like, I think it was about 10 years ago, that may be wrong, but it was around that sort of time. Obviously now we look at Bionics and go, well, that's definitely where the money is. But they saw something then that was quite forward thinking in terms of that sort of technology. So that was really interesting for me to meet those guys. But I also saw some startups, like you say. So I met with Payfont. Payfont are developing a software called IOMI. And it's designed to be really, really secure. So they have they've got an algorithm behind it that they say is thousands and thousands of times more secure than current the AES 256 standard, which was really interesting. They were really interesting to meet. They've got some news coming out later on this year, so we'll be covering that on wired.co.uk. I met with Topolytics. They are tracking waste management. Now that doesn't sound very sexy, but it actually has quite an impact on the countries and the cities that it's being run in.
There's nothing sexy about waste not being managed.
Exactly. Actually, that's a good way of wording it. But what they're also doing is they're putting sensors in factories to make sure that they can track gas levels, for example. And they're using software to track these to make sure. And Dr. Mike Groves explained to me that it's to avoid another Buntsfield. Some of the factories, some of the power plants are in really residential areas. So it's key to get ahead of that. Elsewhere, I met with Pure Li-Fi. They effectively turn light bulbs into routers. They use the light spectrum to create. I know.
Magic.
They use the light spectrum to create data, to share data. What was really interesting about that is that light doesn't travel through walls in the same way that Wi-Fi does. So not only does it avoid this spectrum crunch that we're heading towards, it means it's really, really secure. So they showed me this example where they were stood under one light bulb and they moved away from the light bulb and it stopped working.
Ah.
So the only your device or the devices under that light bulb can actually use that data. So I thought that was really interesting. They were showcasing at Mobile World Congress, actually.
But you can only use it at night.
No, actually, they've done some research as well. So there are certain ways that you can dim it to a certain level so that you can have it on during the day, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also they've done huge amounts of research into streetlights and sunlight and how that all works. And mm-hmm. it is actually possible to be able to do it during the day, doing it that way.
Clever stuff. One thing I wanted to pick out, you met a few people, I think, from Skyscanner, which, correct me if I'm wrong, Roland, this is maybe your kind of area, or Vicky, you might know. Skyscanner, was it Britain's first tech unicorn?
I'm not sure.
That was Autonomy.
Yeah.
But of course, yeah.
Yeah, but that's just, but unicorn is just a valuation of over $1 billion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but they might have been the first acquisition of that amount.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just off the top of my head.
Phenomenally successful business.
And so I met Mark Logan, who was the chief operating officer at Skyscanner. He's left now, but he was obviously there as they grew and then they got acquired. And he was saying that Skyscanner and FanDuel are both unicorns in Scotland. And although we obviously celebrate them, and I think they're great to celebrate that, what that did is it put a spotlight back onto Scotland. So, yes, we've got these unicorns is the way that they talk about it up there. But they're going, but where's the next unicorn? And mm-hmm. not even where's the next unicorn, where's the next breakthrough? Where's the next innovation? And the one key thing that came out of all my conversations with all of the startups and all the people I met was their close links with the universities. Using the talent that's coming out of those universities and the innovations and really making a big deal out of those. And that's what, so I met with a couple of guys from Heriot Watt. They're setting up schemes to deliberately commercialise some of this stuff and put it back into the economy. And if I just go back to archangels really quickly, a study by Strathclyde University did a bit of research into their investments. And a lot of this time, certainly from my point of view, and it might be ignorance more than anything else, I assume that it just lines the pockets of the investors and the companies. But over the 25 years that Archangels have been in operation, they've created 3,000 graduate level jobs. And they've put, I think, something like every pound invested has put £8 back into the economy of Scotland. And I think those are quite interesting numbers.
And speaking about the Scottish economy, of course, this week is particularly pertinent based on what's happening politically.
Well, I was there as the announcement was made, and there was this political underlying in all the conversations.
Not really underlying.
No, maybe not.
What did they say?
Overlying.
Well, the Scottish Investment Bank and Scottish Enterprise had a set amount that it was investing in these companies. And the way that it works is they invest a certain amount based on what an angel's invested. So they'll match it. But that funding has been cut significantly. And I think one of the guys, I can't remember who said it to me now, I met a lot of people, but one of them said, we've almost taken that funding for granted. So there are changes going in place. But what they're quite keen to stress is that Edinburgh is really, really international. The universities, the companies. I mean, when I went to Pure Life, you've got Germans and you've got Dutch people. And so you've got people working together from all sorts of nationalities. And I think they just wanted to stress the point that in a bit way that Sadiq Khan said, you know, London's open. They're like, if we end up leaving, we don't want people to think that Edinburgh's not open. We still want people to come here. And that's what makes the city so great.
Yes. Whereas Edinburgh remains the option that it might be able to secede from the United Kingdom, whereas London is very much lumped with what the whole country decides to do. A lot of unanswered questions, and without wanting to give too much of the game away for what's coming up in Wired, you'll be able to read an awful lot more about it and find out all the cool places to hang out and places to meet people in Edinburgh and lots of other places in upcoming issues of Wired as part of our new Work Smarter section. Our third story this week is a departure once again. We're going to talk about killer robots. Headlines, somewhat sensationalist headlines, have been doing the rounds over the last week after the husband of a woman killed at an auto parts manufacturer in July 2015 filed a lawsuit to try and find out who was responsible for her death.
And, I mean, it's pretty gruesome.
It is, yeah. So Wanda Holbrook was performing, this was in July 2015, Wanda Holbrook was performing maintenance work at the Ventra Ionia, Maine, an auto parts manufacturer in Michigan, when she became trapped and was crushed to death. The lawsuit is going after five engineering firms involved in the creation and operation of the machines used in the plant to try and find out, as I said, who is responsible for her death. And I did some looking into this because... Now, when I say someone has died because of a robot, does everyone kind of get a Terminator sort
of... Oh, yeah, of course.
There's a malevolence in the robot.
They want to hurt us.
Yeah. Whereas the actuality of it is that the robot is too... It's too clever and wants to kill her. Obviously, it's a dumb machine. Yeah. It's a big hulking bit of industrial machinery. It's simply too dumb.
So we want them smart, but not too smart.
Yes.
Smart enough not to kill us, not too smart that they want to murder us.
Yes. Yes, okay. That's it. So
that's a sweet spot we've not nailed.
Well, I mean, in this case, it's just that the technology isn't quite up to standard yet. That once you get in the so-called envelope in which these industrial robots operate, that you are liable to die if they start operating again. The idea is that the safety check's in place, that they don't operate. But once they do, they have no idea that you're there, so they'll swing around and crush you to death before you can even blink.
And that's interesting that they've gone after the manufacturer, and not gone after the manufacturer where she works.
That was going to be my
point.
They're
going after the five engineers.
So from what I can understand from the legal documents, they're kind of going after the whole ecosystem that went into building and maintaining this robot, that there were systemic failures of various safety checks and measures throughout the process. So in going after the five companies, it's another test case as to where blame lies. And I found that, in fact, that the history, if you like, of robot-related deaths is a little bit longer than you might imagine. So the first instance of this being reported was in January 1979, when a 25-year-old man, again in Michigan at a Ford plant, climbed into a storage rack to retrieve parts from a malfunctioning robot, and the robot swung round, hit him in the head, and he died instantly and lay dead for 30 minutes while the robot kept working before anyone realised what would happen. That man was 25-year-old Robert Williams. About a decade later, it is horrific. In 1983, his family was awarded $10 million when a jury ruled against Unit Handling, not Ford, Unit Handling, which is the company that designed the one-ton machine that swung round and hit him in the head. At the time, it was the largest personal injury sum ever awarded in the state of Michigan.
The fact that you're working in such a conditions where no one even notices for 30 minutes, just you and your giant killer one-ton robot.
Yeah, and as I said, when you move into... So these robots are in cages. There is a solid line between human being and robot, and there is an envelope in which the robot's moving parts operate that is meant to be shut down. The robot cannot operate. But obviously, in very rare instances, and this is incredibly, incredibly rare, but it does happen, something goes wrong somewhere along the line. So robot-related workplace deaths have been in decline since that first incident in the 1970s. They've caused 33 workplace deaths and injuries in the United States in the past 30 years, according to the US Department of Labor. So 33, I mean, it's too many because it's a number, but it's not as many as perhaps people might think.
Or the headline suggests.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, this is so coming up with robots that people can, industrial robots that people can work with, is quite a thing at the moment. They're called cobots.
Yeah.
Yeah, so robots that you collaborate with. There's, in fact, one that I was watching a video of recently called Franka. Or maybe Franka's the company that makes it.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, what this robot does is that it won't just carry on swinging around. If it hits you or hits a human body, it'll stop. And the video I was watching was the robot holding a knife, swinging around and touching the skin of its creator, who stood there unflinchingly, and the robot did stop because it sensed that it was coming up against something.
So it gets to the point where it's just like pushing very, very gently against the skin.
Any sort of resistance.
Exactly, yes. Mm. And so, and in fact, this seems to be what people want more from robots.
Yeah.
That will work with them. In this collaborative way, rather than being their masters and yet also
and then
their
being
slaves.
Caged.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So the and there's another problem to look at it in quite cold terms, that these robots being in cages makes them less productive. It makes humans less productive. It makes factories as a whole less productive. And if you can get those robots out and moving around and they become cobots, then the whole productiveness of the factory increases rather a lot, you would imagine. So those kind of issues of a robot working in partnership with a human, for me, go back to the, and everyone sort of knows these from the Will Smith film, but from Isaac Asimov's 1950 novel, I, Robot, that a robot may not injure a human being or through inaction allow a human being to come to harm. A robot must obey orders given to it by human beings, except where such orders would conflict with the first law. And the third law, a robot must protect its own existence as long as such protection does not conflict with the first or second law. So as robots are imbued with intelligence and they're able to not think by themselves but have some sort of awareness of the world around them, that they act not ethically but almost ethically, and that they act subserviently to their human masters and to protect them at all times, is going to become really, really hard but really, really important.
I quite like the solution that they came up with in Red Dwarf, which is to give robots a religion. So that they think that there's a sort of robot god watching over them all the time who's going to punish them if they get it wrong.
And we are the creators of the code, so if that were a workable solution, then, I mean, you could do it. You could persuade these robots of anything. And while I was researching this article, which you can read on wired.co.uk, about sort of the history and problems of killer robots, as they've been called in some of the press, Madeline Gannon spoke at Wired Next Generation in November 2016, and she's known as the Robot Whisperer. And she showed us some fascinating footage of her dancing with these vast, vast robot arms. And Leah, I think you wrote the story about
it. Yeah, when Roland was just talking now about Frank or whoever, this robot with the knife wielding robot, reminded me of this exactly at Next Gen, because that's kind of what she was doing. She wants to work really closely with them. They're not in the cage.
Yeah.
They're much more kind of freewheeling.
But she makes them dance. She makes them give people massages.
Yeah.
And these are things that a flinch could drive a hole in your head.
Yeah. And it's also, she takes these to kind of public places and members of the public can have that massage. And I guess it's kind of bridging that weird discomfort with letting a machine near you.
Yeah, so much as the technology needs to come up to speed, and robots like the one that Roland mentioned will need to be installed into factories, it's also an attitude thing. Humans need to learn that these robots aren't out to get them, that they don't have a built-in malevolence. But the robots of the future will be more aware, I think the point is. So there was a couple of examples of research going on that I wanted to point out, both of them from Ocado, which you might know if you get your food shopping delivered by them. They've also got quite a big and very good technology wing. One of the robots that they're building is it's kind of weird. It looks like its fingers are made of sausages, and it's got soft hands. This field of soft robotics is very, very interesting. Robots that are more cuddly and less metallic.
This really creeped me out.
Yeah,
for some
but
reason.
It's very
really
effective.
Didn't like it.
So the problem that they want to solve is that on a production line where you have like kiwi fruits and any kind of fruit and vegetable, you can't pick them with a robot. It's very difficult. They bruise them too easily because they're just so delicate, and robots are so non-delicate. Is that if you have a sausage finger soft robot, it can pick up fruit and veg and package it really, really quickly, and you can then you remove the need to have humans on that part of the production line. So this weird sausage finger thing picks up fruit and puts it into packaging. And Ocado is developing another slightly more ambitious, and it remains to be seen exactly how far this gets. It's a humanoid robot called Second Hands, which looks a bit like the kind of thing that you're imagining from iRobot. It's this smiling, white and metal sort of humanoid creature thing that acts as the name suggests. It's called Second Hand. It acts as a pair of second hands. And to what Roland was saying earlier, it will hand you a tool when you need it, or if you're going to fall off a stepladder, it will steady the stepladder. It's your hyper-intelligent assistant whenever you need it. But it hasn't been made yet. But it's work in progress.
Until it turns against you and pushes you off the ladder.
That's why we've got to be friendly to them. Cozy up to them.
Yes, that's why they need a religion.
Yes, exactly.
But it's a really interesting field, and one that needs a little bit of realism applied to it when you see the kind of headlines that appear when someone is tragically killed as a result of robots in factories. It's a lot more complicated and nuanced than a lot of the press coverage gives it credit.
It's interesting, actually, this area, because this kind of contributes to a trend that economists call deglobalization. Because for years, we always had industry move, kind of globalizing, basically moving to countries like China, where huge factories produce things. But as you get smaller factories, which can be kind of create more personalized products and be smaller and work with humans, then those factories are more likely to come back to, say, the United States or to the UK, in fact, like Raspberry Pi did, but where you're able to get more automation. And there's Adidas have got a factory called the Smart Factory in Germany, which they're using to kind of to fly knit their trainers. And this is an example of this trend of moving away from globalization to having small local factories. I find it very interesting.
It's a small trend, but it's a developing trend.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
Yeah. Our final story this week, and Roland, the main reason you're here, for all your other sparkling contributions. There's a story in this issue of Wired, or was it the last issue?
This issue.
It's the current issue on sale now, which is our Smart List issue. You did a story on Founders Forum.
Yes.
Which is, now, there's a few who, what, where, when, why's to do with this. So, first of all, what is Founders Forum?
So, Founders Forum is the event set up by a guy called Brent Hoberman. So, if you've heard of, if you remember, know lastminute.com, kind of like the first dot-com business in the UK, that's how I think of it. So it's set up by Brent Hoberman and Martha Lane Fox. Martha Lane Fox is now on the board of Twitter and a baroness and a sort of famous do-gooder. And Brent Hoberman, this is what he does. So he started off with his kind of event founders forum. This has now become the event for startups in the UK. And it's every year it's held all the kind of the big names in startups go along to it. And he's also doing all sorts of other founders-related things, and he's created a bit of a founders empire.
So Founders Forum is sort of the hoi polloi of tech industries in the countries where it is. So there was one in New York, there's ones in London, they're in cities across the world, and it's all the best people from that local ecosystem getting together and having a damn good chat.
Exactly.
That's the idea.
Exactly.
Right.
It's held in a country house somewhere, and all the...
As you do.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, so that's not what the story is about. So we know who Brent Hoberman is now. We know what Founders Forum is now. But the story on Wired is, okay, what's next?
Yeah, so I think the first Founders Forum event was in 2005. So and along the way, Brent has been adding all these different aspects to the Founders brand. So there's a consultancy, there's a recruitment agency, there's a talent spotting thing. And now there's a startup accelerator called Founders Factory.
See, when I was in Edinburgh, I was saying to a few people, what even is an entrepreneur? What's the definition of a startup? What is an accelerator?
Well, settle in, because this is actually a much more confusing area than you might think.
Oh, God.
Well, no, it's okay. Basically, a startup is just a really fast-growing company. That's the best way to think of it. And an accelerator is kind of these schools where young startups or young entrepreneurs learn how to become startups.
Do they learn to go faster? Because the name accelerator would imply that.
Yeah, I mean, that's a bit of marketing. But basically, yes. The first one, or the one that made it really famous, is one called Y Combinator in the US. So this is the accelerator that produced Dropbox, Reddit, Airbnb, loads of big companies you've heard of. And in fact, startups used to kind of emerge nebulously, organically from nowhere. Now, most of them come from these accelerators. And that's partly because going through an accelerator, which normally takes about 6 months, is a great way to get onto the next stage, which is raising funding.
Can I ask, though, accelerators have been around for years and years. There's loads of them all over Europe. What are they doing? Why do we care about them, these guys?
Well, I guess because that's mainly where startups come from nowadays.
No, as a Founders Forum.
Oh, why should we care about these guys? Oh, Founders Forum. Oh, well, they're interesting for two reasons. First, because it's Brent Hoberman, and he's a very kind of successful, well-known British entrepreneur. And secondly, because they've got a slightly different model, which is interesting as a different way of doing this. So they've collaborated with a bunch of corporates, L'Oreal, Aviva, EasyJet, The Guardian. And each of those corporates sponsors a different strand of their accelerator. And so you know how the old idea was that startups would be disrupting corporates? Well, now they're kind of doing it in collaboration with the corporates.
It kind of turns out that you can't live in a permanent era of disruption where there's incumbents and disruptors and incumbents and disruptors and nothing ever settles. But eventually they have to rub along.
Yeah, I guess. Although, so I mean, I asked Brent, I said, so what happens if one of your startups creates a well-meaning left-wing media brand that is very much like The Guardian? Won't The Guardian kill it or kind of try and acquire it? I mean, what would happen in that case?
And The Guardian is invested in
exactly.
The organization.
Yeah, Guardian yeah. Media Group, yeah. And I guess, I mean, he said, well, you know, they need to innovate as well. They need to kind of learn about this stuff. And I think from the corporate's point of view, they don't really have a choice, do they? What do? Ignore it? Get disrupted anyway?
And you've written quite a bit about this, and it kind of goes back to a feature that you wrote a couple of months ago, I think, around the idea of, are startups or are entrepreneurs born or are they made? And this is, it's kind of getting to the idea of a factory, right?
Yes, exactly.
But you can't make them.
He said,
you can't manufacture one.
No, but you can help people. So we were just talking about this earlier. About the idea, say, that you can't teach someone how to do creative writing. And
Yes. I did creative writing at university.
And you said that you wanted to read some of your poems on the book.
No, yes, no, I prepared some beautiful sonnets.
Yeah, no. I guess the thing about this is that there's this romantic idea that entrepreneurs just arise out of nowhere and that it ought to be difficult, because if it's not difficult, then you haven't demonstrated the passion and the will and like the business know-how. This is kind of the apprentice idea, isn't it? That it's all about just wanting it enough. But actually, there's a whole bunch of really practical things, A, that you can teach people. You can introduce them to mentors and give them kind of advice and everything. And then you can help them onto the next stage, which is often getting funding or kind of getting a viable product. And this is stuff you can actually do for people. Having said that, there are a lot of questions about the accelerator model. A lot of well-respected people think that there's a bit of an accelerator bubble. But just the basic idea, I mean, I don't believe in this romantic idea of entrepreneurs. Anyone could be an entrepreneur. It just happens to mean working on your own.
Something that you brought out in the article, you spoke to an academic, and their point was that there's no real difference between the success of an entrepreneur going it on their own and the success of an entrepreneur or business that's been accelerated. Do you take that, or there is a benefit?
So not all accelerators are equal, but Y Combinator, I mean... Well, and also, it's a slightly circular thing, right? So, like, getting into Y Combinator is such a mark of success that then people treat you as if you're successful. So there's no kind of control group study here. But I think some accelerators are really worth it.
But and so it's almost to the extent that it's a bit like you go to university or you go to school to learn certain things. And if you're a startup, maybe you go to startup school, you go to an accelerator to learn sort of startup 101.
Yeah, exactly. And I think in a way, the kind of the bigger thing around this is that, you know, even 20 years ago, startups were rare. Startups were unusual and they didn't. And you know, that meant they could kind of be treated as these strange, unique individuals. But now they're incredibly common. It's that much easier to make things. It really is. And that means there's going to be a lot of kind of innovation in the way that we do startups.
And so a lot innovation of in the model of innovation.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But it's innovation inception.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. But it's the same with venture capital, right? So venture capital used to be only done one way. Now it's done lots of different ways as people figure out different ways of doing this. And I mean, if you accept the theory, and I kind of do, that a lot more businesses and a lot more people will do startups or do entrepreneurialism for a period of time, then it kind of makes sense that there's this whole structure that you go through, a bit like university. But I also think that it is that startups today are much more likely to succeed than they were, you know, even 10 years ago, because we've kind of got better at it. We know what works more now, and there'll always be a lot of failure in startups. But that's
part of the fun.
Yeah, part of the pain and the misery.
Yeah.
But knowing that you get a lot of failure is all part of it, and understanding that you know the best way to do it is, you know, to use the old cliche, to fail quickly. Well, actually, knowing that, I mean, that's really helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. Failure is part of life, Roland.
Ah, how true. Oh, you should write a poem about that.
I will. What rhymes with failure? We won't. No. We'll leave it there. Thank you very much, everyone. We'll see you again next week. No, that was premature.
Oh, dear. Sorry.
Now we're going to have to do it again. Goodbye. See you next week.